books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today we've got a Nero Book Awards special. The Nero Book Awards are a new prize. Although they are the spiritual successor to another coffee company's award scheme that was scrapped after 50 years. Where the Costas had five categories, including poetry, the Nero Awards only have four. The four category winners for non-fiction, fiction, children's fiction and debut fiction were announced at the end of January, and the book of the year was announced yesterday, if you listen to this, on the day it was released and first broadcast. We'll be chatting to Paul Murray and Michael McGee later in the show, but first, let's have a little listen to the 2023 winner for non-fiction, Strong Female Character by Fern Brady.
A couple of times a week I'd have long phone chats with my dad as he commuted the 2 hours back home from his job in London. It was on one of these phone calls that I told him something I'd dreaded bringing up since I'd found out a few days before. So I got diagnosed with autism on Tuesday. Who told you that? His tone implied disbelief. A doctor at the Lorna Wing Centre who specialises in diagnosing adult women with autism, I said, already irritated that he thought someone had just mentioned it in passing or that I'd done an online quiz. All right, traffic in London's mental, eh? One time my granddad had his leg amputated and Dad mentioned it as breezily as you would if you were making small talk about the weather. Granddad's in hospital and we think he's getting his leg cut off. This was followed by a call the next day with a matter of fact. Well, granddad's dead. I paced back and forth around the kitchen trying to keep my cool, my phone still pressed to my face.
Read by Fern herself, this is a book about how being a woman gets in the way of people's expectations of what autism should look like, and equally, how being autistic gets in the way of people's expectations of what a woman should look like. Strong Female Character is a game-changing memoir on sexism and neurodiversity.
You know, I actually had a dream where I told you about the diagnosis and you were so uncharacteristically compassionate and nice about it that I woke myself up laughing. All right. I had a dream that there weren't enough blankets on the bed and I asked Julie to put more on because I was freezing. I began to load the dishwasher while he continued telling me about his dream, oblivious to my lack of interest. I waited for him to finish before I said, well, they say autism can be inherited from one parent, so I guess that's answered the question of which one. Who? Your mother? He asked in earnest. I slammed a knife into the dishwasher in frustration. Are you kidding me? It's you! It's you, you maniac! Have you ever noticed you've no ability to read social cues or people's emotions?
Fern Brady reading from the Nero Book Awards non-fiction winner, Strong Female Character.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
This is a Nero Book Awards special, and we'll try to edit in the winner's name. I'm recording this before we know who won, at the end of today's show. Now, let's have a chat with the winner of the Debut Fiction Award, Michael McGee. His book, Close to Home, is narrated by Conor McNeill.
There was nothing to it. I swung and hit him and he dropped. A girl came flying forward and pushed me. What'd you do that for? The lad was lying there and I was standing over him and there were people all around me making noise. By the time I got away from the tussle, two Land Rovers had pulled up. A jaded-looking peeler with a receding hairline came towards me. Is that blood? He said, pointing to a stain on my shirt that could have been anything. He took my name and number and told me he would be in touch. I held my hands up and said that was no problem. The lad came at me, I said. I didn't know what to do. At the top of the street, the lad was put on a stretcher and the stretcher was heaved into the back of an ambulance. I think it's best you make your way home, the peeler said. I'd have said that he was a good peeler, a helpful peeler. We'll be in touch, he said, and I thanked him. Thanks very much, I said.
A clip of Conor McNeil reading from the audio version of Michael McGee's Close to Home. And Michael joins me now. Now, Michael, tell us about Close to Home.
Well, Close to Home's about, it's about a young guy from Belfast. He's just returned home from university in Liverpool. He's from West Belfast, actually, more specifically. And he's returned home from university in Liverpool, having gone there sort of to try and, you know, escape in some way. And upon returning to his, you know, that sort of world, he sort of falls back into old behaviours. And one night at a house party, he gets into a bit of an argument and punches this guy, assaults him. And it's a pretty bad assault. And I guess the rest of the story then is sort of him coming to terms with what he did, while also trying to navigate a city that's still sort of trying to recover from the 30-year conflict, from the Troubles. And also it's sort of set just after the economic crash in 2008. So there's a sort of economic downturn. There's not a lot in the way of opportunities for young people in particular. A lot of the people around him have lost their livelihoods. And he finds it quite hard to just sort of get on his feet and get a job and all that kind of thing. And I guess like it's also got a lot to do with the fact that he's the only person in his family to have gone to university, the only person in his social group, his group of friends who went to university. And so he feels this kind of dislocation and has this sort of impulse to try and get away. But he doesn't even know what that really looks like. But I guess that's what the journey of the book is, I suppose.
You yourself went away to university and came back, and the book's called Close to Home. So is it quite close to home?
to be fair, it is. It's very close to home in all sorts of ways. It actually started out, the early incarnations of it was a memoir, or at least that was kind of where I was going with it. And I think I probably needed to look at it in that way. At the start, I think the book was actually born out of a writing exercise that a friend of mine sort of set me, you know. It was back in 2016, I just started doing a PhD. I was very, very lucky to be able to get the opportunity to study a PhD in creative writing at Queen's University in Belfast. I think it sort of came with a bit of pressure. I think I was at a point in my life where there was these sort of changes happening, and I was in a sort of period of transition, and I was struggling to find my way in, essentially, to the things I wanted and needed to write about. And a friend of mine, Tom Morris, who's a brilliant writer in himself, he recognized this in the work that I was producing and could sort of sense that something wasn't clicking. And he set me this task of writing a letter. He said to write a letter to someone you know and respect, and just start at any point in your life and go from there. And so that's what I did. I sat down and started writing. And over the course of about 2 or 3 months, this letter, I just kept writing and going back to it. It was almost like a diary that kept getting longer. And after a few months, I sort of had this manuscript that was highly confessional. And I had said all the things about myself and my life and the place that I came from that I had never really been able to say before. And that was, you know, quite cathartic in all sorts of ways. But then I had this sort of manuscript that the whole point of writing it was to write it that no one would ever read it. And so that gave me sort of a degree of confidence and allowed me to speak in a way. And then I guess the next 5 or 6 years was a process of trying to figure out what the hell to do with it, you know, and it was sort of moving back and forth between memoir and fiction. And then I sort of settled on fictionalizing and giving myself that space. And I think that was needed to sort of create distance between myself and the material I was writing about. I think whenever it was too close to me, I couldn't see it. I couldn't. And I think when you're writing, you kind of need to be able to step back. You know, you need that sort of distance in yourself. You need to place yourself in the narrator's shoes and seeing the world through their shoes and not your shoes. Even if the narrator is sort of you or another version of you, you sort of need to see them as somebody else, if that makes sense. And I almost looked at Sean then as a sort of younger version of myself or a version of myself that no longer existed, you know, and then that allowed me that objective distance that I needed to be able to tell the story.
Yeah, talking of distance, the timing of the novel is post-conflict. Was that a more optimistic time?
I definitely think, Meg, post-Good Friday Agreement, which was, you know, 1998, I think there was a lot of optimism, certainly in the early years, or at least like that was the general feeling in the sort of establishment media, but and also in terms of like the politics. But there was also a degree of, you know, there was still a lot of contention and a lot of complicated and complex processes that, that needed to be straightened out. And I think that by the time it got to the economic crash in 2008, there was a lot of fatigue. You know, the political institutions had collapsed several times already by that stage, you know. And then this crash happened, and there hasn't been a process of reconciliation, at least not one that's made any kind of impact. And so the sectarianism that existed throughout the course of the Troubles just sort of reincarnated itself in a sort of different way, that it became sort of institutional in a different way. I mean, it always was institutional, but it was almost like, you know, you had these two political parties that emerged, which was the DUP and and Sinn Féin, and they sort of had their bases, which they had sort of amalgamated through the downturn of the more centre left parties or centre right parties, the UUP and SDLP. That sort of meant that there were these two opposing communities that were sort of contending over votes and resources. And I think that there were a lot of unresolved issues, and that there remains unresolved issues that sort of have profoundly affected people in a social context. You know, we still live in a fairly divided society. That although, I mean, it's interesting now, because at the minute there feels like there's a lot of optimism with the restoration of the institutions over the last couple of weeks. But yeah, I think the elected representatives here rely a lot on optics, and they rely a lot on photo ops and doing things that on the surface look to be going in the right direction. But when push comes to shove, often that doesn't happen, you know. So I think that the book being a post-conflict novel was quite important, particularly for me, because that was the context that I was brought up in. You know, I mean, I was born in 1990, which was 4 years before the ceasefire and 8 years before the Good Friday Agreement. I remember British soldiers being in my front garden and patrolling our streets in West Belfast, but I was too young to have been confronted by the kind of more oppressive violence of that myself, whereas my parents very much were. They lived through it very directly. And so the story then became about that disconnect between my generation and the generation that came before, as much as anything, and how that the trauma of the generation that came before me, my parents' generation, how that trauma had been inherited by us in some way through the sort of domestic space in particular, but also the kind of difficult social environment that we were born into, in an economic sense and also a kind of a political sense, you know.
Was it important to say that in the working class area of West Belfast then?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, well, that's where I'm from, you know, and that's the world I mean, you don't really decide to write about something. It's just the thing that you feel impelled to write. And that was the world I know. It's the world I grew up in and the world that socialized me. And I think I it's a world it's not that I understand it, but it's the world that I feel is most natural for me to convey and to write about. And I think, you know, and it's so interesting because I never wanted to write a Troubles novel, you know. When I was younger, I was like, I can't write a novel that even mentions the Troubles, you know. I felt exasperated by it, and I was sick of hearing about it in all sorts of ways. And then it took a much longer time than you'd probably think for me to click on that a lot of the things that I was writing about, a lot of the people I were writing about, even if they were from my generation, had been in some way indirectly affected. I was sort of looking around and seeing all these social issues around me, the sort of poverty, the neglect, the drug abuse, you know, rampant mental health crisis, housing crisis, and how all these were actually economically and socially tied to that conflict. And the after effects of it were very, very much still prevalent within my generation. Like, and so I could not write about it, you know. And because the Troubles was something that happened, you know, a lot of people across the north of Ireland were affected or indirectly affected by it. There's no two ways about that. Because of the size of the place, you know, everybody knows someone or somebody related to them were affected, whether they were killed or arrested or injured. But the vast majority of the conflict happened in working class areas like West Belfast, you know. Out of the 92 postcodes that make up the north of Ireland, disproportionately over 60% of the violence happened in 12 postcodes that include West Belfast, North Belfast, Strabane, Bogside, you know, different across McGlen, places like that. And so it was, there was a very different experience of the Troubles between different places, depending on your social background. If you're a working class, you can bet your bottom dollar that you probably lived through a much more intense experience of the Troubles than people who lived in Malone Road in South Belfast, or leafy affluence of the Hollywood or Bangor. So, and that was kind of a big penny drop moment for me when I it took me a lot longer to realise that than it should have. But
was it a different place coming back to after university, because the crash happened when you were away? So was it a different place coming back?
Yeah, like it did feel like it. I mean, it was profoundly different. Because what happened was, like, as I said, like similarly to Sean in the book, all my mates went on to do trades, you know. None of the boys I grew up with went to university, and very few of the boys even I went to school with did. You know, they'd started their apprenticeships when they were 16, you know, and the way apprenticeships worked back then, and I think it's pretty similar now, that, you know, you did your 3 or 4 years, and during the first year, you get maybe 50 quid a week on a Friday in a brown envelope, you know. You know, you're working from 7, 8 o'clock in the morning to 5, 6 o'clock at night. It's a hard, hard graft. And you do that for, you know, the money goes up a wee bit in the second and third year. But the light at the end of the tunnel is that you're going to acquire this skill that's going to carry you through life. You know, that the ambition is, and it's a, you know, and people take great pride in that. That's part of their identity. It's who they are. They're tradesmen. They're skilled tradesmen. You know, the hope is that one day they'll have their own firm, they'll run their own business, they'll have their own van, they'll have their own apprentices and workers who work for them. That's their kind of ambition. And suddenly the crash hit. And a lot of my mates were a year, 2 years, 3 years into their apprenticeship. Some of them had just been qualified as well as plasterers and brickies, and suddenly their livelihoods were gone. The crash hit and everything went pear-shaped for them. And the only sort of avenues that they had available to them was, and after having, you know, committed all this time to trying to learn the skill, the only avenues open to them were, you know, service work, you know, customer service, working in Asda, or working in a call center, or working in coffee shops. But then them jobs also became very competitive for them, because university students were applying for them at the same time. And that made it very, very difficult. So a lot of people left and went to Australia or went to America or even England or down south to Dublin, because then places were marginally better in terms of work. But even at that, it was mostly Australia. So I came back, and half the boys I grew up with and were knocking around with, at least the ones who went to do trades, were gone. And the ones that were left behind were the ones who couldn't afford to go. And so you sort of had a really disenfranchised generation of young people there. And so that was just the generation that I was sort of writing about in the book, that Sean's sort of world. And he sort of caught between that himself as a university graduate who suddenly realizes that his degree isn't worth a lot in this economy, you know. And and I think one of his mates, Rand, maybe says to him, you know, what use was this? You know, you went to university and sure, look where it's got you. You're stuck here with us.
The next morning, or later that morning, whatever way you want to put it, somebody was at the door. I rolled on to my side and tried to go back to sleep, but Ram was up. He was shaking me, and he was like, "That doesn't sound good." I sat up on the edge of the bed. It was better to do these things in stages, and watched Ram lean with his ear against the door. "Sounds like there's a few of them," he said. "Men?" "Aye, men." I looked out the window and saw a car parked up out the front of the block. The driver's side door was open. I heard a radio. Not the kind that played music. The other one. "It's not the Peelers," Ryan said. "How do you know?" "Because they would have shouted. They always shout." The knocking stopped. Footsteps echoed out the hall and were gone.
Another clip of Conor McNeill reading from Close to Home by Michael McGee. Now, did you have any hand in the casting of Conor?
Conor McNeill does an absolutely phenomenal job. What happened was, there was a couple of people that were approached to do it, and he was one of them. And they would get people to read a sample from the book, you know, and they had him and two other people. The other two weren't from where I'm from West Belfast, but Connor's from, he's right around the corner from where I am. They sent me a sample with the other two samples, and it took me about 30 seconds to know that he was the guy for the job. And I remember actually listening to it. It was on the bus. So I was on the bus on the way back up the road. And I just stuck my earphones in and started listening. And I think he had read like 3 minutes of the opening of the book. It was overwhelming. It sounded so right, you know. It's just like it was exactly the voice that I thought the book needed, and it was very moving to hear it. I think because you spend so long writing something and so long reading it that you sort of stop seeing it in a way. You know, it's not even doesn't even exist anymore. It's just words, you know, on a page. And I think I hadn't read it for a few months or hadn't looked at it, and then I heard his voice send the words back to me, and it was almost like I was experiencing the book again for the first time, and I was like, yeah, this is the guy. I mean, there's nobody else. And so I emailed back and said, yes, that's our boy. And I think he's done an incredible job. I really do. He's an amazing actor as well, and has starred in some like really good shows, so it's such an honor to have him do it.
Now, you say there's nobody else, but I've heard you reading from the book. Do you not fancy trying a bit of narration yourself?
I would do it. I think that, I actually really enjoy reading from it as well publicly. But I think if the opportunity's there to get an actor to do it, you know, and somebody who knows how to use their voice, and that he was, I just thought it would be better, you know, And I think it would be a hard job for me in a way to do it. You know, it would take probably twice, three times as long to do it than when Connor did it in a day, two shifts. Whereas it, for me, it would probably take about a week because I'd stumble and fall and get the words wrong and use the wrong voice. And whereas he just knows his breath is perfect. He gets the different intonations and the different voices and accents. I think he's just fantastic. And I think if you can get the opportunity to get someone like that, you may as well, you know.
Now, one thing we tend to miss if we download the book from the R&IB library is the cover. Can you give us a wee description of the cover?
Oh, yeah. So the cover is a photograph taken by a guy called Enda Bo, who's a brilliant photographer. He did a lot of the camera work for Normal People by Sally Rooney, the TV adaptation. And he did this series of photographs. Now, he's from Dublin, but he came up to Belfast and did this series of photographs of young people at the peace walls, essentially. We call them peace walls, you know, they're just big walls segregating people. But and he was taking them during the summer, during both bonfire nights, you know, the 12th and August bonfires for, you know, internment. And he did this over the course of about 5 years, and he was taking photographs of young people in and around those two environments. And the one that we were very lucky to get was a photograph of two young fellas taken from like a low angle, looking up at them with the sky as the background. And the two of them are sort of got their heads down, and they look quite morose and melancholy. And there's a degree of sadness in the way they're standing. And I think that similarly to like Connor McNeil, that whenever my editor sent me the image with the cover mock-up, it was the first thing they sent me, and she said she was very, very excited about it whenever she saw it. She was like, you know, I think this is a goer, but, you know, it's up to you kind of thing. And she showed me it, and I was like, yeah, I think it was exactly the right tone, that it sort of gets that sort of vulnerable masculinity across really well. It also sort of pairs really well with the relationship between Sean and Anthony in the book, the two brothers, or even Sean and Ryan, it could be those two, but there's the duality of that, you know, of two sort of vulnerable, sad lads, as it were, that I think worked really well for what the book was about. But it's very beautiful. I think it's a very beautiful image and ties in really well.
Now, the book got glowing reviews when it came out, but now it is the winner of the Nero Book Awards debut fiction novel. How was that?
I didn't expect that at all, but it's really lovely. You know, you put a book out and you just hope it'll be read, for one, you know, and the people will be interested in it and it'll resonate in some way. And so when you win a prize like that, and it's a fairly prestigious prize, it means a lot, you know, and it sort of opens the book up the potential of being read by more people, which is what anybody wants, you know, when they sit down to write. But no, it's a great honor. It really is.
So is it important that it's available in accessible formats, like audio, for someone who wants to read it but for whatever reason can't access print?
I think it's like so important, and I think that's part of the reason why I was so happy when Conor McNeil did the audiobook version, because I knew then that the people that would be listening to it would be getting something that's well done and well made and acted brilliantly. And I think that really adds to the experience of hearing it, you know. And I think the book itself is like, it's a voice driven narrative. Sound in the way I write and the way I go about building sentences is very important to me, you know, and rhythm and cadence and hitting the right note. I sort of think in them terms, you know. So having a very good actor and having a very well produced audiobook for people who are only going to be able to engage in it in that way was really important to me, for sure. Oh, why?
When we got back to the flat, Ram pulled a litre bottle of vodka out of his bag. It still had the security tag on it. I fancied myself as a bit of a schemer, but he was on another level. He demonstrated this with the lie he told our manager to get us out of going to work that night. D, you're not going to believe this. Somebody's broke into our flat. It was a masterclass, that's all I can say. A real performance. The way he came out with it, like he had just walked into the flat and seen the state of the place, the shock in his voice. Our manager lapped it up. Give me a ring if you need anything, he said. We knocked a litre bottle into us, and Ryan hooked his phone up to the Bluetooth speaker. Green Velvet had just dropped Bigger Than Prince, and he turned it up full whack. We strutted around the living room with our chests pushed out, stomping our feet, hyping ourselves up for a big night. It's the best thing about going on a mad one. Getting ready, listening to tunes, asking, does this look sweet or what? We took our time as well. It was important that we looked our best, and that meant ironing our shirts, washing ourselves over the sink, having a shave. At 10 o'clock, Finty McKenna picked us up in a taxi. On the motorway, the argument started. We hadn't decided where we were going. Finty was barred from the box, Ryan was barred from the beach club, all three of us had to steer clear of Limelight since that night we got into a scuffle with a crowd of metalheads who couldn't take a joke. And we couldn't go near Thompson's. Too many people knew our manager. It was a toss-up between M Club and Mono. Both places were rough as toast, but the drink was cheap and the tunes were good. And there was always a few loose ones floating about, looking for a party. Ryan said Mono, Finty said M Club. I said, is there nowhere else? There's the Bot, Ryan said. That was it, settled. We went to Mono.
A final clip of Conor McNeil reading from Close to Home by Michael McGee. It's available in print, in ebook and audio, wherever you buy your books, and it's all available in audio from RNIB Talking Books. And Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you. Cheers for having me.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
Murder Under the Sun, written by Agatha Christie.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Brazil by Michael Palin.
Every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. Enjoy a classic from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Black Beauty by Anna Sewell.
Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte.
Plus, you can enjoy a book for the younger listener or young at heart every Saturday at 9 a.m. with a repeat on Sundays at 3 p.m. and Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
Alice's Adventures in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll.
Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery.
Enjoy your favourite Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
My love of reading is very great, and the pleasure I have derived from books is very great.
Author, actor and creator of Downton Abbey, Julian Fellowes, on why he supports Talking Books.
This whole business of Talking Books matters to me. Reading is everything. You know, when you're blind, reading is travel. Reading is the last way that you can still enjoy certain things that are no longer realistic for a blind person to enjoy autonomously. It is an absolute lifeline, and we can help them keep that lifeline going.
For more information on the Talking Book service and how to support it, head to rnib.org.uk.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Still to come on today's Nero Book Awards special, we'll have a chat with Paul Murray. But first, let's have a listen to the winner of the Children's Fiction Award, The Swifts by Beth Lincoln.
It was a bright, well-dressed morning in early May, and the Swifts were in the middle of a funeral. The house looked very fine. The lawns had been swept clean of leaves, the hedge maze had been trimmed, and the statues had been scrubbed behind the ears. The family had spent the morning practicing their eulogies in front of a mirror, and now they walked in slow procession through the cemetery, faces professionally grim. According to Arch-Aunt Schadenfreude, a funeral ought to look like a wedding upside down. The Swifts had done their best to honour her wishes. The path to Aunt Schadenfreude's grave frothed with flowers, and the trees dripped black ribbon. Cook had even baked a sombre cake with black icing, set on a table just to the left of the headstone. To the right, a gramophone coughed out a melancholy tune.
On the day they're born, each Swift is brought before the Sacred Family Dictionary. They are given a name and a definition, and it's assumed they will grow up to match. Unfortunately, Shenanigan Swift has other ideas. She wants to be a detective, which is lucky, really, because when one of the family tries to murder Arch-Aunt Schadenfreude, someone has to work out who done it.
Shenanigan Swift was carrying the front end of the coffin. She was considerably shorter than the other pallbearers. At the back, her eldest sister Felicity gangled, and her uncle Maelstrom loomed, and although Shenanigan was doing her best to keep the coffin steady, it still tilted forward at a worrying angle. Phenomena, ahead of the procession and guiding her sisters through the cemetery like an air traffic controller, shot her a wary look. Shenanigan tried to think herself taller, with limited success. They wound between the graves like black floss through crooked teeth. Shenanigan read the names of her late family as they trudged past. Calamitous Swift, 1598 to 1652. Adjective. Causing or fraught with disaster. And Godwatery Swift, 1733 to 1790. Noun. 1. Overly elaborate gardening or garden design. 2. Old-fashioned and affected language.
The Swifts by Beth Lincoln is narrated by Nikki Patel and runs for 9 hours and 49 minutes. The 2023 category winner for the Nero Book Awards in fiction was The Bee Sting by Paul Murray. I spoke to Paul when he was in the shortlist for the Booker Prize. In The Bee Sting by Paul Murray, the Barnes family is in trouble. Dickie's once lucrative car business is going under, but rather than face the music, he's spending his days in the woods building an apocalypse-proof bunker with a renegade handyman. His wife Imelda is selling off her jewellery on eBay, while their teenage daughter, Cass, formerly top of her class, seems determined to binge-drink her way to her final exams. And 12-year-old PJ is putting the final touches to his grand plan to run away from home. Where did it all go wrong? A patch of ice in the tarmac? A casual favour to a charming stranger? A bee caught beneath a bridal veil? The audio version of The Bee Sting is read by multiple narrators.
Since the closure of the garage in the next town over, her father has stopped saying things would get better. They knew how bad things were. The whole town knew. Old ladies would come up to Dickie after Mass and tell him they had said a novena for him and for the motor industry in general. Others steered clear, as if his failure might be catching. Sometimes when Cass walked into a shop now, everything went quiet and she felt shame prickle over her like a hideous second skin. A new adversity arrived to take place of her eczema. The crisis had transformed Main Street into a mouthful of cavities. Businesses big and small shuttered in its aftermath. Yet the collapse of the garage was felt by the townsfolk to be of a different order. A fall as dizzying as the Barnes's couldn't come from simple economics. There had to be a moral element. Many of them felt that Imelda was to blame. Dickie made a fortune and Imelda spent too. That was what people said. Imelda, with her cheekbones and her Italian leather boots, got up like the Queen of Sheba just to drive to the supermarket, giving the poor manager an earful because they didn't have star anise or tamarind, or whatever was supposedly all the rage in New York. It's a long way from tamarind she was reared, they told each other darkly. It's a long way from underfloor heating and orthodontists, or any of that palaver. Well, look at her now.
The bee sting is about a family living in a town in the Midlands of Ireland, and they've gone from being sort of big wheels in the town. So the dad, Dickie Barnes, runs the local Volkswagen dealership. So during the kind of the good times, the boom here in Ireland, they've been very wealthy. And then when the crash comes, business is it's almost wiped out, and the family starts to sort of disintegrate under the pressure.
The woods of Belarus are a maze. A green, snow-laden maze that switches itself around whenever he turns his back. It's winter. The cold is blistering. The enemy is everywhere. Grey flashes in the branches, almost too fast to see. "Behind you!" Nev calls. PJ spins round just in time to see a rifle pointed right at him, a shadowed figure fix him in his sights. "Incoming!" He hurls himself into a hollow as the grenade comes down, rolls with the blast, crashes against a tree trunk, hauls himself to his feet and runs without looking back into the trees, the light. "This way," Nev calls, going the wrong way.
Each of the family member tells a part of the story. So it starts with Cass. She's the daughter. She's 17 and she's hoping to go to college in Dublin if she gets through her exams with her best friend Elaine. Then PJ tells the next bit, and he's 12. He's worried that his parents are going to get divorced and he's going to be sent to boarding school. And he's basically trying to stay out of his parents' way as much as he can. So there's a woods behind the house. He spends a lot of the time there with his sort of frenemy, Nev, and also with the mysterious interlocutor who sort of he's only met on online. Then there is the mum, Imelda. She's kind of a famous beauty. She's from a different background to the rest of the characters. She's from a very poor background. So when we get to her section, we start to go into the past and we discover that there's a lot more to the parents' lives than we've thought from having seen them through the kids' eyes. And there's a lot of sort of, you know, there's a lot of sort of trauma and grief that has been kind of buried under the surface for a long time. And Dickie, he's the dad then. Similar story, like we go into his past too, and it's pretty different to what we thought it might have been.
The hole is 4 feet wide and almost as deep as a man. They take turns digging, PJ too, in the beginning, though after they get to a certain depth, Victor puts a stop to it. If the walls collapsed, they would bury him. At first the soil was light and springy, little more than tree roots and dust. Now it is dark and claggy and sticks to the spade. Dickie digs, or Victor. PJ stands at the edge of the hole, ready to receive the bucket and empty it. Access to water is the first and most crucial requirement of self-sufficiency. According to the three threes, a body can last 3 weeks without food, 3 days without water, 3 minutes without oxygen. All things being equal, oxygen shouldn't be an issue. Food you can store and forage for, but water, that's the tough one.
Dickie's obsessed with being a good person, so he really wants to be good, seen as a good man in the eyes of the town. So he's very active in, you know, he gives to the local football club and he employs anybody sort of who's unemployable in his garage. And he really wants the garage, the business, to succeed because, you know, he doesn't want to have to let his employees go. But he's so busy being good that he's kind of sort of buried his true self for a long time. And now as everything sort of, you know, comes to a head, we find the kind of the past beginning to rise up into his life and then from there into the rest of the family's lives.
And it's set in quite a small town, a place where you see people in cars slow down to see if they know you. But you grew up in the city of Dublin. How did you capture that small town feel?
I guess like my mum is from a very small town up in County Monaghan. And I think I drew on that a fair bit for Imelda's past, certainly. And my dad's from Galway, which is not a small town, I should stress. I guess a couple of friends of mine from school and from college married girls from the Midlands, like in the last sort of 5 to 10 years, and they would just tell me stories of adventures they had had in the Midlands, and their wives would tell me stories about, you know, growing up in the Midlands. And I was really attracted to the idea of the small town where, you know, in a city like Dublin's not a huge city, but it's big enough that you can kind of disappear. You know, you can have like different, you can have different sort of identities or live in different ways, you know, at the same time. Whereas in a small town like the one in the book, you're always being observed. You know, everybody's watching and everybody's judging. And like, you know, there's good things about that. You know, it can be supportive, and, you know, you can find that when you're in trouble, people will rally around to help you. But equally, you can find that if you go against what the townspeople think is the right thing, then you can really find yourself in trouble. And that's what happens in the book. So just that idea that, you know, you're a small town is somewhere, I think, each of the characters in a different way wants to escape. You know, they want to escape their lives, and they want to escape that sense of having to conform to this idea that the townsfolk have of them.
Now, there are four different voices in the book. So, of varying ages, did you have to research things like gaming terms for PJ?
Like, no, I'm kind of fairly good at just sort of absorbing those things just from like looking at the newspapers or whatever. I guess the hardest one for me was Cass, who's the teenage girl. I met a couple of millennials. I had millennial consultants that I met just once when I'd sort of started writing her section. And I just wanted to sort of see did the sort of trajectory her life was taking, did that sound authentic to them, you know? And that was really, really helpful. Like, I feel like if you're feeling really tentative about us, like if you're feeling like, you know, oh, I'm not sure this character is actually sort of authentic or not, it's not working. Like if you have to research us, my sort of sense would be then it's not, that voice is never going to sound kind of like fully confident. But with her voice, like I had an idea of what she sounded like and what she would think about. And I did sort of check that out, as I say, with these two kind of millennial consultants. And they said, you know, this completely sounds right to us. So that was great. And that was all I needed. And then it kind of pushed on from there. I think if you're a reader, you do have a certain sense of familiarity with lives that are sort of ostensibly quite different to yours, you know? So if you grow up reading books by like whoever it might be, by women writers, like, you know, Judy Blume. When I was a kid, I read a lot of Judy Blume. And then like reading Laurie Moore, she writes about female friendship very beautifully. And Elena Ferrante, likewise, like all those books resonated with me. So it didn't feel like a huge leap. And then with PJ, like, so PJ's 12 and he's a gamer, but whatever it says about me, like I felt like still, I could kind of connect with my own youth there, being kind of a slightly lonely gamer, you know, trying to escape from like the monotony of like 12-year-old life in fantasy and in like computer games. So all of those stories, all of them felt like fairly natural to me. Like once I got rolling, all of those voices just appeared, which is a blessing.
Will he say it to him at all? Or will he let him slip off back to the Algarve? He still doesn't get it, does he? Born with a silver spoon in his mouth, he still doesn't see what's coming at them. You're a martyr to that man. That's what the girls say. The things he put you through, Imelda. Beside her, the kids both buried in their phones till Maris turns in his seat. You're awfully quiet, he says. Are you there at all? Imelda nudges PJ. No point talking to the other one. Your granddad's speaking to you, she says. PJ looks up, wild-eyed, like he's just been pulled out of a dream. How's that game? Is it the right one? The fellow in the shop said it was the latest installment. Yes, no, it's definitely the right one. Thanks a million, PJ says. What is it, World War II, fighting the Nazis? Right, Only this one's set in the present, so like if the Nazis had won the war, it's an alternative reality.
Alternative reality, is it? Morris says. He turns back around. Well, they couldn't do much worse a job than the current shower.
Now, one thing I missed by listening to the audiobook was the fact that Imelda's punctuation-free was that hard to write? And, well, I think the narrator put the punctuation in naturally as they were narrating it. But was that a hard thing to write without punctuation?
No, it was the opposite, really. It was, I hadn't given much thought to, like, the book is sort of written, like, linearly, like, as you know, so I wrote Cass's section first and then and PJ's and then I came to Imelda's, and I hadn't given much thought to how I would put her story together. And I just started writing as, and she's on the way to, when you sort of meet her for the first time, or when you hear her speak for the first time, rather, she's on her way to this very kind of stressful family dinner, like a, sort of, it's a celebration of Dickie's father, Morris Barnes, in the town. So all the local bigwigs are going to be there and everybody's going to be dressed up. And she knows that the family has to impress. And she's very, very, she's very anxious about it. And she's got a particular reason for not wanting to go back to the hotel where this dinner is on, which carries these sort of memories for her. So I started writing that section, and she's in the car and she's thinking about how much she doesn't want to go to this dinner. And I was punctuating it as normal. And that just, it just felt wrong. It just felt wrong in this really kind of, you've got these gut feelings that you have when you're wrong, and you can't really explain them. Like, you can explain them like in retrospect, but at the time they just feel, something just tells you this isn't quite right. So I just took the punctuation out, you know. The punctuation is there, that makes it sound sort of very kind of experimental and arty, but it's actually, from what I'm hearing from readers, like it's not hard to read. So there's sort of punctuation of sorts in that, like a new sentence, it won't have a full stop, there won't be a full stop at the end of the last sentence, but the new sentence will have like a capital. So you'll be able to kind of tell that it's a new sentence. But it was really, for me, it was about the rhythm. It was really about getting the sound of her thoughts, and the punctuation was getting in the way of that. And that's why I took it out. Like, I really wanted you to feel like inside her head, and like she's speaking to herself, and you're kind of listening in on those thoughts, because her section is kind of different to the kids' sections. Like it's really, like I say, you've been seeing the parents through the kids' eyes up until then, and the parents seem quite kind of, you know, like the way you see your parents when you're a kid, like they seem kind of one-dimensional, and they're obsessed with these kind of quite petty things, like whatever, underfloor heating or you know, wearing the right shirt. So then when you got to her section, I really wanted it to feel like you're plunged into this world that is like, is very, very intense, that you didn't know existed. So getting it right was not about the punctuation. It was more just about like just getting the sounds of the sentences to feel, to kind of getting the weight of the words right and getting it to flow in a very particular way. And so the audiobook was, in the way the audiobook is like a perfect medium for that. And I know the producer of the audiobook, his name is Gray Everly, he works at Penguin. And he worked so hard to find the right cast for each part of the book. And I was quite sort of nervous about having, you know, when it goes into the audiobook, it's a different way of telling the story. It's a different medium, and it's very different. But he picked these fantastic actors, and they did like just an amazing job, I think,
the actors are Heather O'Sullivan, Barry Fitzgerald, Bo Holland, Kieran O'Brien, and Lisa Caruccio-Kame. Did you have any input into the casting at all?
Yeah, I did. I mean, it was really Gray's like production, but he would send me the audition samples from each actor. So there'd be sort of like, there'd be like maybe four or five actors auditioning for each of the roles. And like, for me, it was difficult. Like, that's not my field. So they're all like, everybody I heard was really good. But I guess it was getting the accent right that was what stood out for me, like just being able to get the accent, like that Midlands accent, and getting to express. It was just, I would make my call and say, well, this person is my favorite, you know, because they, you know, they might have, the accent, as I say, was what stood out for me. And they would sort of, the Greg and the others would sort of go off and huddle, and they'd make the final selection. But I would always have input, but my input would end there. So the only things I would sort of have I'd be consulted on further was so the last section. So each character tells a part of the story, and then at the end, the final section, it kind of flips from one character to the next. And as the as that section progresses, the flipping becomes faster and faster and faster. So you're just getting one line from each character. And then the last line is unattributed. So Gray wanted to know like who was going to say that line in the audiobook. So that's kind of one of the big differences between the audiobook and the novel, in that the written novel. On the page, you don't see who's saying it, and on the audiobook, you do.
Yeah, I wouldn't say anything, but yeah, I know the actor who that last line. But the bee sting is available in audio and braille, as is Skippy Dice. Is it important for you that your books are available in alternative formats?
Oh, man, absolutely. Of course. Yeah, it's like, you know, you really want as many people as possible to read the book. You know, that's why anybody writes a book, like it's to kind of connect with readers. And so, yeah, it's absolutely important to me. I would really hate the idea that anybody would be excluded from reading it. So it's important to me, definitely, that, you know, that there's enough copies in libraries, for instance, or that it's available in Braille, or that it's available in audiobook. And that's and Penguin is really great with the audio. I mean, I guess audiobooks have really kind of increased in popularity in the last sort of few years, and they take it very seriously, and they do a really good job on it. So, and I hear from people, like I meet people who like aren't able to read the printed book for whatever reason, and I find it quite heartening, quite moving when they really sort of say, oh, the audiobook, you know, the publisher did a great job, and it really felt, you know, they were able to kind of connect with us in exactly the same way.
Now, one thing we won't get if we download the book from RNIB's library is the cover. Can you tell us a little bit about the cover?
Yeah, so the cover was done by a guy called John Gray, who's I think it would be fair to call him like a design legend at this point. He's really done like so many, any number of incredible sort of book jackets. So I was really excited when I heard that he was going to do this my book. And it's a really eye-catching image. So booksellers will tell me, like if you go into the bookshop, like it sort of jumps off the shelves. It's yellow and black. So it's bee colors. My name is in the middle in black letters, and the book's title, Bee Sting, is beneath that in orange letters. The background is yellow, and there's a bee in the top right corner. And the bee's kind of line of flight has been kind of traced around the letters of the, or traced around the title and the author name. But instead of being sort of like a wavy, sort of curvy line of flight like you might expect from a bee, it's all been done in these kind of like rigid, straight lines. So there's lots of straight lines and right angles with the effect that like it looks like a labyrinth. It looks like kind of a maze surrounding the title and the author name. So it gives a sense of like this the plot, which is quite labyrinthine, and also kind of like the characters are kind of enclosed, trapped inside this story that they're not in control of.
Well, now the cover also has that little sticker that says shortlisted for the Booker. You were first nominated in 2010 for Skippy Dice. Does that feel different this time round?
Yeah, it does, actually. I mean, I think I was so kind of astonished with Skippy Dice that I kind of wasn't really able to take it in. This time it was a big story here in Ireland because there was four Irish authors longlisted. So that it became sort of like a big kind of new story. And to get from the longlist to the shortlist didn't happen with Skippy Dice. I mean, that's like it's like another dimension again. Like there's so much excitement about it, so much publicity about it. So it's like it's really like a phenomenon, you know. So the last kind of few months have been pretty much about the Booker and not much else. So it's like it's a crazy time, like it, but it's wonderful. Like I don't think there's any other prize that has that kind of level of excitement. And
now, as you say, apart from half the shortlist being called Paul, there were four Irish authors on the long list and two went on the short list. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, it's a good time for polls. So there was four of us on the long list. So Sebastian Berry and Elaine Feeney were with us on the long list. Then myself and Paul Lynch went through to the short list. And I mean, I don't know. It's Sebastian Berry said, let's just call it a miracle. And in some ways, that's as much as you can say. But I think Ireland, like it's a country where through good times and bad, and there've been a lot of good times or bad times here, like historically, it's always been a culture that valued reading. So just people read books, you know, a lot of people here read books, and books are part of the kind of the national conversation in a way that they might not be in other countries. So writing is something that people feel like they can do. And I think that's the most important thing. And then sort of like the kind of the background to that, you've got the state, there's a fair bit of support from the state in terms of like there's an arts council, which is very supportive of authors, like both starting out and established. There's a tax exemption here for artists. So that helps too, you know, because like writing obviously isn't something that makes you like a massive amount of money most of the time. So you can kind of get by as a writer, and you're recognized as a writer, and that work is seen as like, you know, having kind of an importance or a value in a way that it might not be elsewhere. And like stuff like, I mean, I spent a semester in the US last year, and people were saying like, how can you be a full-time writer? Because in the US it's impossible. No, it's because there's no health system unless you're rich, you know, you can't afford, unless you can afford health insurance. If you get sick, you're in really serious trouble. Whereas here, that's not the case, you know? So the older I get, the more I realize that like, it's actually, you know, it's a lucky situation to be in, like being an Irish writer, that's a good place to write.
Of course, in the eyes of the world, it is a disaster to be kicked out of the family business, to lose the job he'd been groomed for since he was a child. He doesn't know how he's going to explain it to Imelda. Still, as he steps back onto the street, Dickie feels like jumping for joy. His father is gone. The missing money will stay an unsolved mystery in a ledger on a drive. And Dickie's secrets too will remain buried in the past.
The Bee Sting by Paul Murray is available now in print as an ebook and in audio as read by Heather O'Sullivan, Barry Fitzgerald, Bo Holland, Kieran O'Brien and Lisa Caruccio-Cami. It's also available from RNIB Talking Books in audio and braille. And Paul, thank you so much.
Thanks, Robert.
And that's it for today's Read On. Except to reveal the winner of the Nero Gold Prize Book of the Year, which was the man you've just heard, Paul Murray. He was named the first ever recipient of the Nero Gold Prize 2023 Book of the Year and takes £30,000 for The Bee Sting, which is his fourth novel. The judges said the writing is both accomplished and highly readable. The characters shine and the family members' individual story arcs are all equally compelling and gripping. And it's available from RNIB Talking Books in both audio and in braille. And we've run out of time, see you next week.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.